Welcome to As It Is, a 30-minute program designed for English learners. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anne Ball, Bruce Alpert, Christopher Jones-Cruz, and Anna Mateo. Mernush Karimian Ainsworth will tell us what's trending today, and later, John Russell and Jill Robbins will have this week's lesson in everyday grammar. But first, here is Anne Ball.
The United States government has begun the first clinical testing of an experimental vaccine designed to guard against Zika virus. The National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases made the announcement earlier this week. Anthony Fauci, the Institute's director, said on Wednesday that investigators should know soon whether the vaccine is safe for use in human beings. He said the first human tests involve 40 human volunteers in the U.S. If we get a good immune response and there are no safety red flags by the end of December 2016, we should know if it's okay to move on to phase two. He said the second phase could begin early next year. Infected mosquitoes can pass the virus to people. Zika usually causes minor problems in healthy people. But there is a real danger if an infected insect bites a pregnant woman. The infection could spread to the fetus she is carrying. If infected with the virus, women can give birth to babies with a severe condition known as microcephaly. The heads and brains of those babies are unusually small. Microcephaly can cause many mental and physical problems and even death. The vaccine was developed with a relatively new technology. It was scientifically engineered to contain a small piece of DNA from the virus. The piece is so small that it is not infectious. But it is big enough to produce a reaction from the body's natural defenses for fighting disease. Zika infections have been reported in 50 countries and territories. Most cases are in Central and South America and the Caribbean. I'm Anne Ball.
Sarwat Hussein is an American Muslim from Texas. She says people there sometimes look at the hijab she wears over her head. But Hussein got more attention than she was used to on a flight to Orlando, Florida. It came from the man who sat next to her on the airplane. Hussein said that after the plane took off, the man said, "If this window was a door, I would have pushed you out." She said she answered, "I would have taken you with me." She said the man laughed at her answer and said, "Oh, you're so funny." She answered, "Sir, what you said was not funny at all." Hussein was flying to Florida for a meeting of the Democratic Party's Platform Committee. The meeting was called to finalize plans for the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. Hussein set up the San Antonio office of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. She also helped create the American Muslim Democratic Caucus, a political organization known as the AMDC. And she has been working with the Democratic Party to help provide better political representation for Muslim Americans across the country. The AMDC formed in the years after the terror attacks of September 11, 2001, to answer the hatred its members believed was directed at Muslim Americans. The group also wanted to persuade more Muslim Americans to take part in the political process. Hussein said her recent flight to Orlando showed the need for Muslim Americans to become more involved and visible in American politics. She believes this will help slow what she believes is an increase in Islamophobia. After forming in Texas in 2004, the AMDC has expanded to 79 chapters. Hussein believes it will continue to grow. She says the group's goal is to increase the number of Muslim Americans who hold political office. She admits there are some people who do not want her to succeed. There are also some people who think having a Muslim will hurt the party, she said. Hussein said another barrier to increased involvement of Muslim Americans in politics is the challenge of persuading them to vote. The Pew Research Center estimates 3.3 million Muslims live in the United States. The center predicts the number will double by 2050. Muslims are one of the fastest-growing communities in the country. But many Muslim Americans who can vote do not. Tahir Ali works at the American Muslim Alliance. He said the lack of voting is not the fault of the American government. He said their experience with voting in other countries may be the reason so few Muslims in the United States decide to vote. Where they come from, the process may not be clean. It may be corrupt. It may be rigged also, he said. Ali said that is why many Muslim American immigrants who become U.S. citizens and gain the right to vote do not do so. We have to educate them that this process is a very clean process, he said. We have to educate about the calculation of votes to the youth, to the ladies, so that they can think that it is their right to exercise their vote in order for them to be recognized. Sarwat Hussein said voting is sometimes not important to immigrants. Many of the immigrants, they are still trying to settle down their roots. You know, take care of the family, raise their children, because this is an extremely family-oriented society, she said. The children of immigrants, she says, are beginning to vote. They include people like Noman Kanani. Now you are starting to see more second-generation Muslims get a little more involved, said Kanani. But a lot of them are still around my age, in their mid-20s, early 30s, so it's still too early to tell. So I think in the next 5 to 10 years, you are going to see more and more of them involved. Kanani admits it can be difficult to persuade immigrant parents to tell their children that voting is important. I don't know how many people actually see this as an urgency, he said. A lot of immigrant parents tend to push their children towards sciences and engineering-related subjects rather than politics. Sarwat Hussein saw many young Muslim Americans at a recent AMDC gathering in Philadelphia. She hopes the next Muslim American political candidate was among them. Being involved in politics is a form of worship in Islam, she said. The land you live in, you must serve that land at every level, in every respect. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
Sandstorms are a major part of life in the Sahel area in Africa. The Sahel stretches from Senegal to Ethiopia. The area is also called the meningitis belt because of high levels of the disease meningitis that exists there. Now, new research suggests sandstorms may be the cause of the high number of bacterial meningitis cases each year in the Sahel. British and Belgian researchers think high winds from the storms are to blame. They say the winds force sand, other small particles, and the bacteria that causes meningitis deep into the respiratory tract. Researcher Daniel Neal is with the Institute of Infection and Global Health at the University of Liverpool. He says it is common for people all over the world to have bacteria in their breathing passages. He notes it is usually safe. But what's very rare is for these bacteria to move from the nose and mouth and throat to places like the brain, lungs, or bloodstream where they cause severe disease, Neal adds. We were able to show that the dust increases the chances of the bacteria moving from the mouth, nose, or throat to the sites where they cause severe infection. Over the past 10 years, there have been about 1 million cases of bacterial meningitis in the Sahel, he says. This resulted in about 100,000 deaths. Neal and the other researchers reported their findings in the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology. The group spent 8 years studying dust storms in the Sahel, an area with 26 countries and 300 million people. The main country they studied was Niger. The researchers studied periods of visibility during the storms. They measured levels of sand and other particles in the air. They found the lower the visibility levels, the more cases of meningitis there were. Researchers believe sand debris is the problem. During a dust storm, the debris causes irritation to the inside of the nose, mouth, and throat. The irritation makes it easier for bacteria to enter the rest of the body. Neal adds that the hot climate in the Sahel causes bacteria to release toxins. These substances make it harder for the body's natural defenses to fight infection. Antibiotic drugs and vaccines have reduced the number of meningitis cases, he says. But the number might be reduced even more if people going out in the storms covered their faces with scarves or gauze material. And that's something that we could test relatively simply, Neal adds. Dust storms most often happen during the Sahel's dry season, the hottest part of the year. By studying climate conditions, Neal says it may be possible to predict when the most dangerous storms are likely to strike. I'm Patrick Melanchi.
The tallest men in the world are Dutch, while the tallest women come from Latvia. That finding comes from a new British study. It also found that East Timor is home to some of the shortest men on our planet, while the shortest women are in Guatemala. Scientists from Imperial College of London studied height measurements for young adults over the past century. The scientists found that between 1914 and 2014, people in some countries have grown taller, while average height shrank in other areas. The study found that Dutch men now have an average height of more than 182 centimeters. Among Latvian women, the average height is 170 centimeters. Those numbers represent an increase for both countries since 1914. The question to ask is, why? Philip Wilkins is from Amsterdam, the largest city in the Netherlands. He thinks diet and exercise might explain, in part, why Dutch men are so tall.
Maybe they eat more potatoes, maybe they eat more bread than other people. We are sportsmen, so we do a lot of sports, and maybe that's why we grow a little faster.
He might have a point. Scientists agree that sport has something to do with how tall a person is. Silvia Umbrasko is from Riga Stradins University in Latvia. She says that the height of women can be increased by playing sports and through exercises. She adds that sports such as basketball, volleyball, and even handball help a young person grow because of the stretching exercises that are used. Experts agree that physical activity is important for physical growth. Other studies have explored possible links between a lack of emotional attention and physical growth. But scientists also add that growth depends mostly on diet and environmental and genetic factors. Sanda is a tall woman from Latvia's capital, Riga. She says, "I'm so used to my height that I don't pay attention to it. However, I've heard that guys like tall girls, so it is a good thing." In 2014, the top 10 tallest nations for men and women were mainly in Europe. Many scientists believe that people in Europe have grown taller in recent years because of improved nutrition. However, the average height in many African and Middle Eastern nations has declined since 1914. In East Timor, the average man is 160 centimeters tall. Many people are also short in Yemen, Laos, Madagascar, and a number of Asian and African countries. The British scientists say that the United States reached a plateau in growth about 20 years ago. In other words, the average height of young adults has changed little during that period. But really, who cares? Is there a good reason for being tall? According to some earlier studies, the answer could be yes. For example, one study explored the relationship between a person's height and their future earnings. American researchers led this investigation. They found that taller workers receive a notable wage or earnings premium in developing economies. Their findings were reported in the Journal of Human Capital. I'm Ana Mateo.
This is what's trending today. Olympic athletes from around the world are in Brazil to compete in the 2016 Olympic Games. Most of the competitors are staying in the newly opened Olympic Village. Some have criticized living conditions within the village. Members of the Australian Olympic team, for example, decided to find somewhere else to stay until repairs were made in their building. Some athletes had another concern. There were no Pokemon to hunt in the Olympic Village. People could download the game in Brazil, but there were no Pokemon in the village. But that has not stopped one Olympian from trying to hunt Pokemon. Kohei Uchimura is a Japanese gymnast. He is a 6-time world champion and the defending Olympic champion in men's gymnastics. Somehow, he has found time to try to play Pokemon Go since arriving in Rio late last month. Uchimura recently received a nearly $5,000 telephone bill. A lot of that money is for international roaming charges. This means his phone service did not include data when traveling in other countries. Thankfully, the AP reported, his phone carrier has agreed to reduce the amount. He will now pay a much lower fee of $30 for each day he is in Brazil. Uchimura told Kyoto News that he really lucked out. And that's what's trending today. I'm Mernush Karamian Ainsworth.
Many English learners have spent a lot of time studying the parts of speech, adjectives, nouns, and verbs, for example. But sometimes studying the English sentence from a larger perspective is useful. One way to get a bigger view of English is to study common sentence patterns. The English language has many patterns. In the book Rhetorical Grammar, author Martha Kuhn describes 7 common sentence patterns. In other writings, she says that 95% of sentences in English fit into basic patterns. Understanding and mastering common patterns will not only help you do better on grammar tests, but improve your writing skills too. For example, here is a passage written by Ernest Hemingway, a famous American author. It comes from the short story, A Clean, Well-Lighted Place. The story is one of the most famous ones that Hemingway wrote.
This is a clean and pleasant cafe. It is well-lighted. The light is very good, and also now there are shadows of the leaves.
Do you notice patterns in these sentences? If you do not recognize them, you will by the end of this report. In this installment of Everyday Grammar, we are focusing on 2 of the most common patterns in English.
Consider a line from the song Beautiful by Christina Aguilera. The line shows the foundation of most sentences in English. A sentence equals a subject or a noun phrase plus a predicate or a verb phrase. A phrase is a group of words that act as a unit. A noun phrase has an important noun, the headword noun, along with words and phrases that give more information about it. The subject of a sentence is the whole noun phrase, not just the noun. The predicate is a verb phrase with a main verb and the words and phrases that give more information about it. If you take the sentence from the Aguilera song, you can analyze it like this.
The subject is I, and the predicate is am beautiful.
In this sentence, the adjective beautiful acts as the subject complement. It describes I, the subject. So, the song lyric is the first important sentence pattern in English.
Pattern number one is subject plus be plus subject complement.
The subject complement can be either an adjective or a noun phrase. For example, consider this line from the music group Queen. In that line, the subject is we. The predicate, are the champions, contains the be verb along with a subject complement, the champions. This noun phrase is describing the subject, we.
You might find sentences that appear more complicated, but use the same basic structure. Consider this song by the Beatles. Baby, you're the rich man. Baby, you're the rich man. Baby, you're the rich man. At first, the sentence appears complicated, but the basic structure of the sentence remains the same. Subject plus be plus subject complement. The difference is that the sentence has added information. A noun that is the same as the subject of the sentence.
Baby, you're a rich man. Or, noun, subject plus be plus subject complement.
The subject plus be plus subject complement pattern is not the only pattern you will find with the verb be. Consider these two sentences.
My friends are at the concert. The test was yesterday.
In these examples, the subject and the be verb are followed by adverbials, which are, in this case, words or phrases that tell where or when. In the first sentence, the adverbial structure is the prepositional phrase at the concert. In the second sentence, the adverbial structure is the adverb yesterday. These examples show another common be structure, subject plus be plus adverbial.
Think back to the Hemingway passage from the beginning of this story.
This is a clean and pleasant cafe. It is well lighted. The light is very good, and also, now, there are shadows of the leaves.
The second sentence clearly uses a pattern one structure.
The subject is it. The be verb is is. The subject complement is well lighted. The sentence is, it is well lighted.
But if you look closely, you will see every sentence in the passage uses pattern number one. Two of the sentences use conjunctions, but they still depend on the same basic pattern. Hemingway was famous for his short, declarative style. However, he did not write using basic pattern one and two sentences only. Good writers know how to make their sentences come to life. They do not write the same sentences over and over again.
I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm John Russell.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.